Thank you for downloading this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. CFR is an independent national membership organization and nonpartisan research center. For more information, please visit us online at cfr.org.
Good afternoon from New York and welcome to this special CFR conference call. I hope you all had a terrific summer. I'm Irina Faskanis, the Vice President of the National Program and Outreach here at CFR. Today's call is on the record and the audio will be available on our website, www.cfr.org, if you would like to share it with your colleagues. We are pleased to have with us Elliot Abrams and Ed Hussein, both of whom are senior fellows for Middle Eastern Studies here at CFR. They bring great expertise to our conversation on Syria and have been writing op-eds on the topic in the National Review and elsewhere and making media appearances. Prior to coming to CFR, Ed Hussein was co-founder and co-director of the Quilliam Foundation, the world's first counter-radicalization think tank. Formerly an activist and member of Muslim Brotherhood Front organizations in the United Kingdom, he is now a strong critic of extremism and Islamism, and he is the author of The Islamists with a forthcoming book on the Sufis. Elliot Abrams was recently appointed to the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. He was previously a member of the commission from 1999 to 2001 and served as the chairman in the latter year. He served as deputy assistant to the president and deputy national security advisor in the George W. Bush administration, where he supervised U.S. policy in the Middle East for the White House. Thank you both for joining us today to talk about this serious issue. Elliot, let me first start with you to give your take on what's going on in Syria and what you see coming down the pike, and then we'll turn it over to Ed.
Thanks very much, Irina. I'm very glad to do this, although my guess is that when we end this call, no one will feel happier about the situation than when we start it. What's new in Syria? Now, I would say, not much, in the sense that we have seen for a year and a half a kind of stalemate. The rebels, the opposition, cannot dislodge the Assad regime. But Assad cannot crush them. He cannot end the rebellion. So on and on it goes. The only development that one sees in the press recently is more reports of additional or stepped-up Iranian help for the regime. But there is also, it seems, additional help for rebels from the United States, from perhaps some countries in Europe, and certainly from some of the Sunni Arab states. So if you have increased help for both sides, what you get is a continuation of the fighting, perhaps at higher levels. And we now have numbers of something like 23,000 dead, and there was certainly a big uptick in the number of refugees in August, when it was said to be 100,000. So these figures are very imprecise, but there are a very large number in the hundreds of thousands of internally displaced persons and people displaced into Turkey, primarily Turkey, Lebanon, and Jordan. In fact, we have actually coming to CFR in Washington next week the Jordanian Minister of Planning, who wants to talk about the economic impact on Jordan of what is going on in Syria. The level of outside help is not particularly great, it seems. The United States, for example, clearly now has contact with the rebels, and we have publicly announced that we're helping them, but not with lethal help. That is, they're not getting any arms from the United States. They may be getting communications equipment and the like, but no weapon systems. The president announced a few weeks ago that we would see the use of chemical weapons as a kind of red line. Unfortunately, that appears to have been interpreted, if you will, upside down by the Syrian regime. That is, if the use of chemical weapons is the American red line, then anything short of that is not an American red line. So stepped-up Iranian help is not an American red line. more use of helicopter gunships or fixed-wing jet aircraft by the Syrian Air Force is not an American red line, and we've seen more of that. Now, the American position is that Assad must go, but it is also that we're not ready to try to impose a no-fly zone. And when I say that's the American position, it's kind of interesting. It is the president's position, but it is also the position of his opponent, Governor Romney. Neither of them currently supports a no-fly zone. And it's interesting to me in a sense that Syria is not caught up in our election much. It seems that neither party believes the American people want to get very deeply involved in another Middle Eastern conflict. And while the Republicans have criticized the Democratic administration on this, it has not certainly been near the top of the list for the critics of the president who are running for president, let's put it that way. So there doesn't seem to be much taste for a vastly increased American role either by either party candidate. The French and the Turks are a little bit ahead of us here. Both of them have called for consideration of no-fly zones. And the French in particular have even talked about recognizing a government in exile. I'll stop just by saying I think this position on the part of both candidates, Romney and Obama, could change depending on events in Syria. For example, while there are 23,000 dead, that's been, if you will, a slow-motion massacre of citizens. If that speeded up, if you had one or two events that really caught the attention of the American people, the conscience of the American people, you might have a call for trying to protect Syrian civilians more and to include a no-fly zone in that, assuming that we could get the Arab League cover for that and that we could get, I think we would never get it out of the Security Council because of the Russian position, but if we could get Arab League cover, NATO cover, that is something that I think still might happen even before the U.S. election. Just finally, there is an EU, worth mentioning, there's an EU foreign ministers meeting today to talk about Syria, and we'll see if the French manage to move the EU position to a more, let's say, interventionist one. And the rebel side met this week for 2 days in Jordan and are talking about trying for greater unity, particularly of greater unity and command and control on the military side. Why don't I stop with that? There's obviously so much to talk about, and turn it back to Irina.
Great. Thanks very much, Elliot. Ed, over to you.
Irina, thank you, and thank you, Elliot, and thank you, all of you, for making time this lunchtime. I'll make sort of several points, and I'll try to be very quick and brief. The first point is that I'm in agreement with much of what Elliot says, and without any doubt, the need for the Syrian warlord Assad to step down and to support, in broad terms, the rebels. But the difficulty is that we don't really know much about the very composition of the rebels. And what's happened over the last 18 months, for whatever reason, whether it's the lack of Western involvement or otherwise, although I'm not sure if Western involvement would have stopped this, but I think it would have increased what I'm about to say, and that is the revolution or the uprising in Syria is no longer what it started out in March 2011, when it was a group of school kids in Daraa wanting the regime to fall, and they were inspired by what they saw in Egypt and Tunisia and elsewhere. What we've seen now increasingly is of the 30 rebel groups, and the FSA is simply one group of the 30 different factions that are fighting across the country in very sporadic terms, at least 15 plus, and I think I'm being moderate in my estimation, are now dominated by radical Islamist organizations. Al-Qaeda is among them, and this has been documented by Al-Qaeda itself, as well as Muslims from European countries now in their hundreds traveling there and back. So the Syrian conflict is no longer just a Syrian conflict, but it has become a hub for drawing the most extreme form of Islamists from the region and beyond. So the first point to note, I think, is the revolution has been hijacked. And that's not just the case in Syria. It's happened in other countries. But in other countries, the hijacking has been of a different sort. In Egypt, it's been of the more comparatively, relatively sort of moderate wing of the Muslim Brotherhood, although some may criticize using that kind of language, but in relative terms to or on the Islamist spectrum. So that's the first point to note in Syria. The second point to note, I think, is that the Syrian rebellion has, in the eyes of many, and I say this on the basis of meeting people in London who were involved with satellite television channels reporting from inside Syria, Syrian opposition television channels, several of them funded by the State Department, it's become a cottage industry. So 40 to 45 young, unemployed men described to me as country pumpkins get together, go and kidnap government officials. Now, in a country such as Syria, where the government or the state is deep, when I say the deep state, I'm talking about school officers, school teachers, school officials, post official people. So the government is ubiquitous and present everywhere. Anyone who can kidnap people who are allegedly from the government, put them on some kind of YouTube video with an Islamic flag in the background, broadcast that video then to their contacts in the Gulf, raise money for fighting a jihad against the infidel, that's the Alawite regime. What then happens is money starts to flow in. So in the presence of, you know, 30% plus unemployment in a country before the rebellion, now with unemployment and safety, you know, levels worryingly high, what's happened is this has become a new form of employment for people as their family members, i.e. women and children, move out to Jordan and Lebanon and Turkey, as Elliot mentioned. So this is a real problem, that this is becoming a city versus countryside development. This has become a rebellion fueled by people, the Gulf Muslims of the Sunni Salafi mindset from the outside, and it's become a form of employment for people to fight against the regime. I'm not in any way diminishing many of the crimes that the regime continues to commit, but I think it's worthy of remembering that, you know, what we're seeing isn't necessarily an uprising for freedom and democracy. And I'll end by saying two things. And the first is that parts of the so-called Free Syria that we're seeing emerge, a report in yesterday's Christian Science Monitor, for example, documents that when these areas become free from the regime, what happens by default is not just the Free Syrian Army, but the other 29 or so fighting forces, by default turn to Sharia as state law. Now, that's not the kind of Syria I think we should be encouraging, where Sharia becomes state law under parts that the FSA controls today. It's not necessarily an uprising of the sort that we've seen in other countries. So I think there's real concern there as to the kind of Syria that the newly hijacked revolution, I think, wants to see. And the last point would be this, that one of the factors that we've ignored over the last 17, 18 months is trying to understand the key influences on the Syrian uprising. On the side of the regime, undoubtedly Bashar al-Assad and his close circle, Bussein al-Sha'ban, and others who've been involved among the Alawis, we know what their game is, and you know there's no surprise there as to who the main players are. But on the other side, what's been overlooked is men such as Adnan Arour, you know, a radical Salafi cleric expelled from Syria in 1982, now has refuge in Saudi Arabia. He is by far the most influential cleric inside the country, not taking direct control, but mentoring many of the ideas that are finding home among the revolutionaries. And, I mean, ask any Syrian rebel as to who their intellectual godfather, if you like, is of the is of this uprising, and it's Adnan Arour, a Salafi cleric from Saudi Arabia. So to summarize then, I think it's worthy us sort of taking a step back and thinking about, yes, it's part of the American or the Western impulse to find a solution to every problem, but it's worth remembering that not every problem has a solution, and sometimes when the solution is applied, the situation becomes worse. And sadly, Syria is one of those situations in which very few options for resolving the situation exist, and the options on the table can lead to the situation becoming far worse than what it is today. And my final thought would be that I think we're in this for the medium to long term. We're not going to see a resolution anytime soon. The conflict or the civil war, whatever we may wish to term it, will last with us for at least the next 5 to 7 years.
Well, thank you both for that insightful and sobering overview. Let's turn it now to questions from the group and comments.
Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we would like to open the floor for questions. If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your touch-tone phone now. Questions will be taken in the order in which they are received. If at any time you would like to remove yourself from the questioning queue, please press star 2. Once again, to ask a question, please press star 1 on your touch-tone phone now. Our first question will come from Satpal Singh from World Sikh Council.
My question. Obviously, the situation in Syria is really very stark. And most of the discussion about intervention or no possibility of intervention is in terms of politics or political world. And obviously, it seems, as has been discussed, there may not be a political solution to this. We wish if faith leaders could do something. Is there a possibility that any group of faith leaders, either from Muslims themselves or a wider spectrum of faith leaders, can do anything? And if so, then what could that be?
Well, this is Elliot. I'll take a crack at that. I am dubious about this because, as Ed mentioned, one of the ways in which this fighting breaks down is along religious lines. I would think that there would be a role for faith leaders after the fall of the regime, because we will all be trying to put the pieces back together and avoid further escalation of violence. And that is a moment at which leaders of various faith communities, and of course it's a 74-75% Sunni country, so Sunni leaders would be particularly important, could, I think, play a role in attempting to prevent more violence, prevent revenge actions, and I can't see it really having an impact today.
I'd follow on from that, Elliot, and I'd add that thus far, to be completely candid, faith leaders have been part of the problem. And I say so because the state mufti inside Syria has been stoking the flames, threatening to dispatch suicide bombers to European capitals on 3 instances. State faith leaders such as Sheikh Ramadan al-Bouti, hugely influential Friday preacher in his 70s, a man who bestowed legitimacy on Hafez al-Assad, Bashar's father, has gone out of his way to repeatedly say that the Syrian uprising is a Zionist Israeli conspiracy. Faith leaders include people like Adnan Arour from the other side. Faith leaders from Hezbollah and some of the Shia clerics have also stoked this as a return of the Karbala crisis between the Prophet's grandson and the Umayyads back in the 8th century. So thus far, sadly, the faith leaders of various denominations have been part of the problem. But that said, I'm in agreement with Elliot that I think post-Assad, there's hope. And I mean, next week, the Pope is in Pope Benedict is in Lebanon, and I think it'll be an interesting time to watch what happens there in terms of people perhaps rallying around him to find some sort of faith-based inspiration to address this. But thus far, the signs from faith leaders from across the board, whether it's the Alawis, the Druze, the Ismailis, the Shias, the Sunnis, the Christians, thus far, I'm sorry to report, have not necessarily been laudable.
See, in my view, as an outsider, one part of it which might lead to be a possibility for faith leaders to play a role would be that part of the problem is from faith leaders. So the outside world faith leaders who are not part of the problem, and those who feel about the human rights situation, which is really very stark, if they can get together and have a feeling and they can influence the faith leaders within the country, that would actually be a possible route to address the situation. Of course, I'm speaking as an outsider, not understanding the situation too well, probably.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question will come from Robert Pelletreau, retired diplomat.
I had a question for you regarding Israel's position. It seems to me that Israel is facing a dilemma here. On the one hand, it wants to break the Iranian supply arc that goes all the way from Iran through Syria to Hezbollah in Lebanon. On the other hand, Assad Syria has proven no particular problem for Israel. There are tacit agreements with respect to the Golan, and the Assad regime is probably pretty thoroughly penetrated. How do you see Israel's position?
Well, I think the Israeli position has changed over time. I think you described accurately what it has been for years. There were efforts even as recently as, 2007, to do a secret negotiation through Turkey between Israel and Syria. And when this rebellion began a year and a half ago, I think the Israelis were not so keen about it for the reasons that you state. The border with Syria was a stable border. They've changed their view, though, because Syria is now obviously completely unstable, and because the level of violence is very high, and there's a possibility that it will, events in Syria will destabilize Lebanon and or Jordan. My sense is that at this point, they would like to see this over, most of all. That is, they would like to see the regime fall, and they view time as a problem. That is, the longer this fight goes on, the more the radicalization will take place, the more Sunni Alawite relations will become poisonous, the more jihadis will arrive in Syria. So they would like to see the end of this, but they are not involved in this at all. That is, they're keeping, as near as I can make out, a very much a hands-off position, and don't see an Israeli role except worrying.
I was in Israel about 6 weeks ago, and I was stunned by the level of close, detailed attention being paid to developments inside Syria by people across Israeli society. That struck me as something. And interestingly, in close contrast to my visits to Egypt, where people have been focusing on their own domestic challenges inside Egypt, fellow Arabs, fellow Sunnis, I hasten to add, inside Israel, the focus was very much away from many of the Israeli domestic difficulties, but focusing on, and with great empathy, I hasten to add, on developments inside Syria. That said, I would caution against any belief that what comes after Assad will somehow be better for Israel in any way. Yes, the link with the Iranians may well be broken, but let's not mistake for a moment that the kind of society that Hafez al-Assad and Bashar al-Assad and the kind of education system that they put in place over the last 30 to 40 years and the people that have been accustomed to state media inside Syria has resulted in a generation of people who don't recognize Israel, who detest anything remotely to do with Israel, who have strong claims on the Golan Heights, and the Golan Heights, I think legitimately to be Syrian territory, but it's how you come to an end of the Golan difficulties. So whatever comes next after Assad will not be a regime that's necessarily pro-Israeli in any way, and probe any of the rebel forces, and you will see that they too harbor deep anti-Israeli, anti-Zionist sentiments. And that should come as no surprise to us today, and we ought to be prepared for what comes the day after, that this is not going to be a regime that's in any way, pro-Israeli, or dare I say pro-American for that matter.
I would agree with that. I do think the Israelis are torn, as Bob Pelletreau suggested. They have a real dilemma, because without Syria, that is, with a Sunni regime in Syria, let's say, Hezbollah is weakened, and Iran is weakened, and that is obviously something very much in the interests of Israel, and that is their great current security problem. Future developments in Syria are, in a sense, a security problem around the corner. So I agree with Ed. They're watching this very, very carefully, and they, and as I said before, worry a great deal about where it is heading.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question will come from Felice Gare, the Jacob Lowstein Institute.
Hi. Well, congratulations for this call, and it's a pleasure to be speaking with Elliot again. I wanted to raise the question about protection of minorities now. Of course, the minorities are part of the problem in supporting the regime. But if we look forward and think about a post-Assad Syria, a lot of commentators are concerned that there'll be a bloodbath along the lines of what we saw in Iraq, the destruction of Christian minorities and so forth. Whether or not the Alawites flee to the mountains or not is a question we'll leave to Fuad Ajami. But my question to the two of you is, are there measures that can be taken right now that could protect, that could be put in place to try to deal with this question of protecting minorities from a sectarian bloodbath or from this kind of separation along the lines of what we saw in Iraq? Are there things that could be done right now rather than waiting until after Assad and the Assad regime have fallen?
I have one thought about that. In the post-Assad period, it seems to me it is possible to think of some kind of peacekeeping force, some kind of international presence. I mean, there are a number of international forces in the region which separate. There are forces in Lebanon, for example, and in UNDOF in Syria, UNIFIL in Lebanon. It is conceivable, I think, to begin to plan, to begin to talk at the UN with a number of potential contributors of troops who would not be fighting a war. They would be attempting to keep communities separate and provide some protection. Obviously, the UN record here is mixed, but I would think that this could work and could really deter or diminish the amount of intercommunal violence. And I think it is true that, you know, we have no idea when this might be useful, but I would think that one could start thinking about this and quietly planning for it.
In terms of what can be done right now, again, it's worth acknowledging that while, you know, we've been rightly excited about the Arab uprisings or the Arab Spring, one of the net losers of the Arab Spring across the region have been religious minorities. You know, whether it's Christians in Tunisia or Christians in Egypt today, or other religious minorities across the region, you know, they've seen the rise of Sunni Islamism as a political force in various manifestations. And, you know, whether it's just in the public space or whether it's real impact on the ground in terms of the religious rituals being compromised or the lack of large gatherings in places such as Shubra in Egypt post the revolution, those are real concerns on the ground. Now, given the general feeling in the air, Syria is perhaps the worst victim of all of this, in that an immediate measure that comes to my mind would be that, you know, the Sunni Salafi clerics that are encouraging the rebels to fight along sectarian lines and attacking the Alawi regime along religious sectarian lines, you know, A, you ought to stop that, and B, should be encouraged, whether it's by outside friends such as the U.S. or others, should be encouraged to incorporate the language of inclusivity and say that, you know, they're all Arabs and they're all human beings and they're all people of faith, and regardless of different backgrounds, Syria should be a pluralist home for different faith denominations. Now, even as I speak, I can hear in my head the voice of people on the ground inside Syria saying it's far too late for that,
well,
because the sense of revenge and anger and the thirst for blood on both sides, but particularly among the Sunnis, who feel that there's been an injustice done to them over the last 30 years, and how dare this religious minority group of, who were essentially their servants back in the 1960s, now use the army to get right to the top of the Syrian political infrastructure and openly, you know, kill Sunni civilians, and not just kill them because they're political opposition, but in the process of killing, Assad Shabiha or his militias have used the language of religion and sectarianism when dishing out hatred. So the situation on the ground, I'm sorry to say, is just you know, too bitter, too angry, too emotional, too much of seeking revenge immediately, to now start to say to people, actually, you know, you must forgive one another. One side must win, Assad must fall, and after that, all of this can then be put to the table, I'm afraid.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. As a quick reminder, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your touch-tone phone now. Our next question will come from Robert Puckett, Indiana State University.
The chances are for safe zone protected by Turkish troops.
I'm sorry, the question is what are the chances of...
What are the chances, you know, in along the border in Syria itself, a safe zone that would be protected by Turkish troops?
I think it is possible. We're not there yet because the Turks have so far decided to manage that inside Turkey.
Mm-hmm.
There are large agglomerations of refugees, and the UNHCR is helping them cope. We, the United States, announced an additional contribution for these purposes yesterday. But the Turks have talked about this, and I think as they see the situation in Syria grinding down, getting worse and worse, and they see larger refugee flows, it seems to be quite plausible that they will at some point say, we don't want another 150 or 200,000 Syrians coming into Turkey. Let's do this on the Syrian side of the border. I would have to say, though, I think they won't do that alone. They won't do that, I think, without American support, because that means there are going to be Turkish soldiers inside Syria. I don't think they're going to make such a decision unless they have Arab League and American and NATO backing to do it, including potentially air cover for those locations.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question will come from Don Rogers, Catholic Relief Services.
Oh, thank you very much. And thank you for the presentation and the dialogue so far today. My question is whether either of the speakers has any reflection on the role the UN has played up till now, the success and lack of it that have gotten us to the situation we are now, and also whether or not looking forward there's a chance that the UN, I noted the point about the peacekeeping groups, but other than that, whether there was a role that the UN could positively play in this conflict. Thank you.
If I may, Elliot, I mean, when the UN is welcomed this time round, the most recent diplomatic initiative, i.e. Lakhdar Ibrahimi, and it's welcomed by Iran, and it's welcomed by Russia, and it's welcomed by Hezbollah, I worry, because I think the wrong people are welcoming it. And I'm not sure that Lakhdar Ibrahimi and the most recent initiative will succeed where a seasoned diplomat such as Kofi Annan, with all of his past failures, has again failed on Syria. And it seems that, and you know, we've got to be candid, that the UN has, with good intentions, it must be said, provided diplomatic cover for Assad to be seen to be engaging with, quote-unquote, the international community, while keeping his massacres ongoing. And this happened on the UN's watch when the last UN group of observers were there. The only positive side to the UN being involved is that some level of international community engagement is there, and also that the rebels and others feel that there is, however weak, some sort of arbitrator referee that they can go to, and that there are people on the ground, however compromised they may be, that can from time to time document what's going on and back up the claims made by the rebels. But on balance, with the UN's track record and the lack of full Security Council backing, I am not an optimist for what the UN can do in Syria.
I would agree with that. I think with respect to the Security Council, the problem is Russia. And the Russians have made it very clear that they feel they were kind of hornswoggled over Libya. It's not going to happen again. They're going to block everything, really, when it comes to Syria, except statements from time to time. So you won't get anything in the Security Council. You will get, at the other end of the spectrum, in the UN agencies, I think UNHCR and perhaps others can be useful. I share Ed's criticism of Kofi Annan. I don't criticize him for trying, but it seems to me he should have quit much sooner. His mission kind of ended with a whimper. And I think that had he much sooner announced that he was not going to be used this way, he was not going to be a facade behind which more massacres would take place, he was not going to be a facade behind which, frankly, Western governments, including our own, could continue their inactivity and say, oh, we're not being inactive, we've got Kofi out there, I think he would have salvaged much more of his reputation. I think he waited far too long.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question will come from Kimberly Martell from KME Consulting.
Good afternoon. My question is related to the growing humanitarian situation with refugees going across the borders. Is the international community taking any role in trying to improve the conditions that currently exist in the camps?
I think the answer is yes. You know, the funding is always inadequate. UNHCR is, of course, always trying to find more resources. But I think we, the United States, the EU, and others have made some contributions. Obviously, the conditions in the refugee camps are not good, but they're not awful either. I mean, they're not, in terms of things like food, shelter, health, they are, I would say, up to UNHCR's normal standards. The problem is that the numbers keep growing, and I think one looking at the situation in Syria would have to project that they will continue to grow. So more and more resources are going to be needed. A separate problem, and one we have a lot harder time dealing with, is displaced people inside Syria. That's not a UNHCR problem. It's an International Committee of the Red Cross a problem, but our ability, for example, as the United States, our ability to access those people, the international community's ability, is much more limited, and one reason is safety. You can send any number of internationals into Turkey or Jordan to help out because they're safe. Inside Syria, it's a very dangerous activity.
And winter is looming, and at the beginning of August, the Turkish government, who then had 80,000 refugees, said they could only take up to a total of 100,000, and that was just inside Turkey. By the end of August, just in August itself, that an additional new 100,000 refugees left Syria. Many of them went to, not necessarily Turkey, but to Jordan and Lebanon, and with winter looming, the situation can only get worse. And Elliot's absolutely right on the questions of the need for additional funding and resources.
Great. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question will come from Father Andrew Bouchel from Foundation of St. Paul.
A question for Mr. Hussein and a question for Mr. Abrams. Thank you both for taking the time to speak to us today. First, Mr. Hussein, what kind of coordination among the Muslim Brotherhood do you see in bringing back Sharia law, and do you see them dealing with the question of the people of the book? For example, in Egypt, we've already seen St. Catherine's Monastery receive significant pressure and confiscation of properties despite the Akhname of Muhammad, which gave Christians rights and was affirmed and reaffirmed under Ottoman rule. Most Christians are Orthodox and look to the Patriarch of Antioch, who's now in Damascus. What kind of risk do you think Orthodox Christians are in, and do you think that these historical considerations will go the way of the Christians in Najran, which received a letter similar to the Akhtanameh. And then for Mr. Abrams,
sorry,
why
if I may interrupt, this is in which country?
In Syria. Okay. The Akhtanameh was issued for the Christians in Egypt. Mr. Abrams, why is it you think that Mr. Romney has not spoken about the problems of religious freedom for Christians in what will likely be a more religious Muslim majority in Syria? He is, after all, a member of a religion which has suffered persecutions, and we've already seen coordinated attacks against Christians and others in Egypt, Iraq, and Tunisia. The Mandaeans, for example, have almost been wiped out. Do you think the Russians will move to protect the Orthodox as well, as we saw in the Crimea? Those are my questions.
Great. Who wants to go first?
Ed, do you want to go? You were
sure. Yeah, Elliot. In terms of coordination within the Muslim Brotherhood inside Syria for trying to impose Sharia as state law, to be fair to them, right now their focus is on fighting, the focus is on fundraising, and the focus is on politicking and dominating both the Syrian National Council outside and their members on the inside, identifying strong fighting forces and fighting side by side, to be completely candid, with Salafis and people on the right of the Salafis, i.e. Al-Qaeda jihadists. That's their current focus. But that said, more than any other group, I think they're looking towards the future more. We saw that in other countries across the region. So my second point would be that judging by the trends in other countries in the region, the Muslim Brotherhood at the moment is not looking towards embracing their interpretation of Sharia as state law. Even in Gaza, that was not where they went immediately. So their post-Assad plan would not be to wholeheartedly embrace Sharia as state law as quote-unquote, the Muslim Brotherhood's organization. But that said, my third point would be what we're already seeing is those parts of the country that the Free Syrian Army controls or has been designated as Free Syria, and do look at the Christian Science Monitor report on this, they've already by default started imposing their interpretation of Sharia as state law. So it's a real concern as to what comes the day after. And therefore my suggestion would be one of the things that the United States government and other governments who are supportive of the Syrian opposition can do most, more perhaps than try to win this in the short term by arming them, is to try and help these fractured people to unite, to provide them with platforms to come to some kind of intellectual vision that has, a liberal pluralist society that comes after Assad and not what, the more hardline elements within the Muslim Brotherhood would want to introduce. So thus far, in summary then, little indications of trying to impose Sharia state law afterwards because the focus is on fighting. That said, wherever they've won, what we've seen is Sharia state law being imposed in parts of what they call Free Syria. So the jury is out as to what happens nationally inside the country after Assad falls.
Let me try to answer the question put to me without getting into any partisan politics. I think Romney has made some comments about religious freedom, and I know the Republican platform, for example, does specifically mention the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom and call for continuing to support its work. But I don't speak for the Romney campaign, and I probably should not answer the question further than that. But you mentioned one other thing that I did want to pick up on, and that's Russia and the Orthodox. The Lebanese Christians are mostly Maronites, but it is right that Syrian Christians are mostly Orthodox. And I think that is one explanation, not the key one, but one explanation for Russian policy towards Syria. And I think that in a post-Assad Syria, the Russians would probably attempt to stand up for that community. They'll be trying to salvage whatever they can in Syria at that point. There is a close relationship between Putin and the Russian Orthodox hierarchy in Moscow. So I think it's very likely that the Russians would try to help in any reasonable way they could.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Once again, as a reminder, to ask a question, you may press star 1 on your touch tone phone now. Our next question will come from George Moffitt, CFR.
Thank you. This has been so helpful. I'm wondering if you both are in fundamental agreement with the reticence of President Obama and Governor Romney to impose one or more no-fly zones over Syria.
Let me start. I have my initial position was that we should be working much more closely with the rebels. This is a year and a half ago. My criticism of U.S. policy over this year and a half has been that we have been much too passive. If you go back to, say, a year ago or 15 months ago, the problems that Ed described early on, that is the growing presence of jihadis from all over the world coming to fight, and the intercommunal violence, the degree of bitterness between Alawis and Sunnis, didn't exist, or it barely existed. And it just gets worse. It just gets worse every month. Time has been the enemy of the Syrian people, and it's been the enemy of our policy. And I have been critical of the administration for doing much less than I thought necessary. A year ago, we were hearing, we can't arm the rebels because we don't know them. We were hearing that this summer, too. If we don't know the rebels a year and a half into this civil war, that is a failure of American policy. That is, our intelligence agencies, primarily CIA, were not told, go out there and get to know who those people are and find out who are the people who are reasonable and decent and won't steal our money and actually are fighting for a better Syria. I have not supported the no-fly zone, but I would have to say that I'm getting there. It seems to me that what's happened now, frankly, in particular, since we drew the red line, we, the United States, drew the red line of chemical war, chemical weapons, the regime in Syria is now using its air force more and more and killing more and more people. There's a reason 100,000 people flee in August, and it is that the level of violence is higher. And I think that I don't think it would be impossible to do this. I don't think we'd get it through the Security Council, but with Arab League and NATO and Turkish support. You know, the question that I'm asking myself is how many people have to be killed by jets and by helicopter gunships in Syria before we think a no-fly zone is necessary? And I'm just about there myself.
Ed, do you want to add to that?
Yeah, I share Elliot's instincts on this, but you know, I come to a different conclusion, and that is the imposition of a no-fly zone is essentially a declaration of war, and you know, one can easily sort of counter that by saying, well, there's already a war going on, and Assad's already declared a war. But the downside is that imposing a no-fly zone has several difficulties. One, who are we protecting here? Yes, innocent lives are at risk, and yes, they should be protected. And no, this regime should not be killing them. But are we giving air cover for Al-Qaeda operatives and Hamas supporters and America's and Israel's worst enemies that then defeat a regime and then put in place something worse? And unless that question is answered, unless we know the thorough composition of the people on the ground, and by every reckoning so far, based on open source material, the fighting is dominated by people who are of the problematic category. So my instinct is, at this juncture, no. You know, the no-fly zone should not be imposed. But that said, if the fighting continues in the way that it is and the rebels aren't successful with rocket-propelled grenades and other ammunition that they've been supplied with to down Assad's aircraft, which is another option, of course, if they're not successful with that, then I think the lead on anything that's military, and I include a no-fly zone in this, should be taken by the Europeans, the Turks, and the Arabs, and the United States of America should be one removed from any direct military engagement, which includes here a no-fly zone. The U.S. has other priorities, you know, whether it's Iran, Yemen, Pakistan, Somalia, the Sinai in Egypt, Libya, much else is going on, and, you know, including, you know, the the debt level at the home level, at the home ground here. So there's much more for the U.S. to focus on. Let the Europeans, the Turks, and the Arabs lead on this one if there is going to be a no-fly zone. And my last point would be, it's worth remembering over the Iraqi no-fly zone back in the early 1990s, the then Secretary General of the UN, Boutros Ghali, made a huge deal in the region afterwards to go out and say that it was illegal for the U.S. and its allies to impose a no-fly zone. Now, we may dismiss Boutros Ghali's words, but it sets a precedent, and precedent may be dangerous, that whenever there's an uprising against a regime, that if the regime responds, in this case harshly, or in future cases harshly, and then the rebels, as they did in Libya, will then also cite the example of Syria, and then it becomes incumbent on the international community with the so-called, you know, responsibility to protect doctrine. And then it puts us in territory as to, does it happen in China if the Chinese see a rebellion? Will we do the same thing in parts of Russia, Saudi Arabia? Where next? So this, you know, it can open up a can of worms that puts international relations on footing with a new form of anarchy rather than some sort of rule of law.
I think where you and I disagree some, Ed, is I'm not willing to say that the center of the opposition, the center of the armed opposition, has shifted now to the jihadis. I think they're there. They've engaged in some acts that we would probably call terrorism. But the center of the opposition, for example, the so-called Free Syrian Army, the defected Syrian officers who are either in country or are in Turkey or Jordan, are Syrians. And I think I would estimate that as being at a lower level than you would, although I have to say that's an estimate, and I have no access these days to intelligence information. I don't know what the U.S. government knows about this.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question will come from Robert Leakin, American Jewish Committee.
This has been a tremendously informative discussion. I was wondering if you could expand a little bit on Turkey's sense of its own long-term interests in what's happening in Syria now, and what, if any, strategic options they have to advance those interests.
I could sort of respond initially on some of this. I mean, Turkey is touted around the region now as this, you know, pseudo-Islamist government that's been broadly successful on issues of economic strength when its neighbors such as Spain and Greece and others have failed, that it's a serious knocker on the doors of the European Union, that it has international clout as a member of NATO, and that it's emerged as a democracy with all of its flaws on the issues of the of Kurdish repression and media repression. It's emerged as a democracy that's now free from the control of the military. Now, the largest Arab country in the region, Egypt, looks to that. The Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood has cited the Turkish, quote-unquote Turkish model as something that they would like to embrace, at least on economic terms and better relations with the states, the United States, and better relations with Europe. Now, Turkey has its own problems. In addition to wanting to be a regional stroke global player, for Turkey, Syria represents not just a large border, but a former colony under the Ottomans, but a real internal question of the Kurds, what happens to Iraq's Kurds and Syrian Kurds possibly forming some kind of alliance. Does that then lead to fueling the PKK and other forms of Kurdish dissent inside Turkey? And I think Turkey has a genuine concern about that more than it does, say, wanting to see another Muslim Brotherhood-dominated government in Syria, which in the eyes of many inside Istanbul is inevitable if Assad falls, so wanting to see, you know, another regime that's favorable towards Turkey. But I'm not convinced if that's what drives it more than the Kurdish question, because the Assad regime was favorable towards the Turks for at least 10 years.
I think that's right. I think the critical question, and the immediate question, obviously, is refugee flows and how to deal with them. But I think the deeper question for the Turks is indeed the Kurdish problem. Syria is about 10% maybe just under Kurdish. So it's a sizable population, and I think that's something the Turks are very concerned about. I would add just one more note, which is one or two or three years ago, we were hearing that the major change in the Middle East had been that Turkey was now going to be the dominant power. And it is striking to me that in this more than a year and a half now of rebellion, violence, difficulty in Syria, the Turks have really not done very much. They have given something of a safe haven in Turkey, not just for refugees, but also for rebels. That they have done. But despite the many threats they've made against the regime, they haven't really acted. And I still believe that they won't really act in any dramatic way unless they have the United States behind them. So the notion of Turkey as some kind of hegemonic power in the region, I think, is being disproved.
Thank you both. I know there are lots of questions in queue, and we're at the end of our time. I don't know if you each wanted to take, do a quick wrap-up of any points that we did not cover, although I think you were pretty comprehensive.
Let me just thank everyone who's on the line. We've had some old friends of mine, like Bob Peltro and Felice Gare, and it's been good to hear their voices. And I thank everyone who's participated in this, because at the humanitarian level, it's a terrible and growing problem, and one that I wish actually there were more discussion about in the United States. So I'm grateful that all of you have been interested enough to be with us today.
Ed?
Yeah, no, absolutely echoing Elliot's comments there, and to thank you, Irene, and to thank everyone for making time. And do continue to watch this space, because Syria is an important player in the region, unlike any other country. Unlike any other country in the region, Syrians compose of the Alawites, the Druze, the Ismailis, the Shia, the Sunnis, the Christians, and no other country has all of those denominations in those numbers. Lebanon comes as a close second. So it's a country that's worth watching, and the crisis isn't going anywhere. So your attention to it and ideas coming forth will be much welcomed.
Well, thank you both, Ed Hussein and Elliot Abrams, for today's call and for everybody for joining. I hope you will continue to follow this issue on our website, cfr.org. Elliot is writing a blog on the on our website, so you should tune into that. And Ed is a prolific tweeter, so you should also follow him. Elliot, do you tweet as well?
I do not. I'm shamefacedly must admit.
Okay, so people should tune into Elliot's blog. It's called Pressure Points. It's on the homepage of CFR.org. And Ed, what is your handle?
It's Ed_HUSAIN. So @Ed_Hussein.
Great. So thank you all for being with us today for this Council on Foreign Relations conference call. We are off to a terrific start, and we'll have a very full and exciting program here, and we look forward to your involvement in the coming months.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. For additional audio, video, and transcripts of CFR meetings, as well as expert analysis of international news, please visit us online, cfr.org.